There's a simple reason that Ernest limits me to 20 minutes. He knows that I'd use any extra to address myself to him. And fearful of that, he holds a gun to my back. There is a title to tonight's exchange. I can't remember it because it was very bad. But I'd like to change it anyway. It seems to me that the topic tonight is Irving Kristol. And so I began by...
And the rectification of his errors.
That's for you to conclude at the end. That Irving Kristol is, without any question, a man of great sincerity and profundity. He seeks to push beyond the clichés of the modern disaffection of both conservatives and libertarians in order to discover how we came to this point and how best we should proceed from here. He sets such a high standard of intellectual and visionary achievement that one such as I, steeped in positive theory and individualized ethic and the economics of the marketplace, should certainly fear to tangle with him on the esoteric battlefield of classical philosophy, utopian millenarianism, and the interdependencies of intellectual history and current events. On the other hand, if even this giant of the intellectual milieu should announce to this audience that gravity is the cause of inflation, few of us would hesitate to pronounce him ill-informed, to say the least. And yet, an error of almost that magnitude occurs, I contend, in his discourses on the nature and behavior of modern corporations. I can't keep saying Dr. Kristol. Irving starts, as is quite correct, by giving his view on capitalism's role in the intellectual and political history. Naturally, the definition of capitalism that he contends with is that capitalism understood by the relevant masses. It may have been at one time the capitalism of John Calvin, at another time the capitalism of Horatio Alger. More recently, it is certainly the capitalism of John Kenneth Galbraith and Ralph Nader. For surely, those are the views of capitalism shaping the intellectual and political events of the day. But unfortunately, it will not do to explain all real-world events in these terms. It is as important to know the reality of economics and market forces as it is to know the influence of the pervasive misconceptions about these ideas. And it is precisely this latter understanding that has been denied us in Kristol's trenchant and, I fear, influential writings on the modern large corporation. The error begins, I would suggest, with the notion that all collectivities have the same kind of reality. I believe, however, that there are at least three, and possibly more, significant characteristics of collective entities that must be distinguished if we are not to be misled by economic illusions that are all about us. The first of these, and the one that I believe Irving refers to almost exclusively, is what I believe we mean by the term communitas. It is a continuing, real, and existent spirit that pervades, defines, and shapes a collection of individuals associated in myriad ways. It especially characterizes stable family groups and certain religions, neighborhoods, schools, clubs, and on occasion, nations. It is generally a benign spirit, much beloved of those who call themselves conservatives and rarely appreciated for its virtues by those disruptors of established patterns misleadingly called liberals. A second kind of collective reality is a weak, almost deceptive shadow of the first one. It is that weakly felt, though real spirit that pervades groups without the true sense of community and of community values mentioned above. Substituted for the real collective essence of the first variety is an ersatz, often vaguely coercive or legal sense, usually more taught than felt, that a collective entity truly exists. This form of collective is, I suspect, characteristic, for example, of most heterogeneous nation states today, the remnants of some tattered organized religions, philosophic memberships such as liberalism or conservatism, and enforced status organizations like unions, the AMA, stockbrokers, minority racial groups, and the poor. A commonality exists, but not the true essence of community. Finally, we come to a third category, or what I would refer to as the pure market product, not collectives in any meaningful sense at all, even though to those not familiar with the mysterious workings of markets, they may seem the most real of all the entities. Foremost of these pseudo-entities is the modern, multi-shareholder private corporation. For regardless of what the intellectual community or the masses or politicians may say about it, it is preeminently an ordering derived from the unstructured, unplanned, and uncoerced private decisions. It illustrates in microcosm the great Friedrich Hayek's notion of a social order appearing without plan, a shape without a mold, a harmony without conscious direction or interests of its own. It is unfortunate that this last distinction, perhaps one of the greatest of Hayek's many contributions, should remain so studiously ignored by intellectuals, historians, and philosophers alike. It describes, as well as any single point might, that social behavior which is derived from a philosophy of human dignity based on individual freedom and responsibility rather than on any notion of divine ordination. What I intend is that we must not confuse corporations with communities. We must not deceive anyone to believe that the relationship of shareholders to each other is anything like the relationship of brothers or of members of a happy college faculty. We must not perpetuate the myth that corporations as such do anything or have any interests or responsibilities of their own. And most important, we must deny, on pain of loss of our own community of interest and rationality, that corporations are anything but the legal vehicles by which individual interests, individually pressed, are joined together in a symbiotic relationship benefiting all. The corporation is, above all else, a function, not even a creature, of the market. It can be understood properly in no other terms, and to try to do so, as I believe Irving has, is equivalent to trying to understand nuclear physics in terms of the social community and moral values of electrons and protons. Another derivative function of the market is the private contract. Yet, when we buy a house or a flower pot or a super tanker, we do not talk about the political effects of the contract's behavior. We do not say that a contract has a social responsibility. We don't claim that the parties to the contract should form a political party to protect contracts from their enemies. And we certainly do not say that it would be tolerable, to say nothing of desirable, to have an independent third party supervising the performance of every contract. What we do say, of course, is that for good or bad reasons, contracts to do certain things are illegal. We do not allow the legal sale of babies or of heroin. We also say that legal contracts are to be performed by the parties and enforced by the courts. We may, moreover, declare by social pressure or by law that individuals should or should not enter certain contracts. For example, we say that it is impolite to buy and consume too much alcohol. We tell our children not to contract for too much TV, and we may urge our friends to refrain from using Russian or Arabian products. But we never say that the legal construct of a contract is morally reprehensible, that it is an entity with social, economic, or political interests, or that a contract can do anything. We all know that, or do we? For the modern large corporation, for all its size, complexity, intertwined interests, and political anthropomorphization, is just a contract. Just a form of interaction derived from the interplay of myriad individuals operating in the market. But there are, unfortunately, two major opportunities for error by observers in this characterization of the corporation as contract. The first I've already identified as the nature of the corporation itself. It seems too big, too complex to be considered just another contract. The difficulty here lies with the lack of comprehension of the many dimensions of the concept. They include, but are not limited, to the interests of shareholders and debtors, the common stockholders, preferred stockholders, warrant holders, bond holders, and so forth. The managers, including officers, directors, various subordinate employees, union leaders, and government regulators. The creditors, including potentially customers, employees, suppliers. And the idea further involves a number of discreetly identifiable markets, all intertwining in this concept of the large corporation. These markets include the market for capital, the market for managerial skills, the market for political skills, raw materials and labor services, the market for information, and finally, the market for control of the corporate assets themselves, functioning, as it were, through a market for votes. That, in turn, brings me to a second opportunity for miscalculation in understanding the corporation as a purely market function, and that is the concept of a market itself. There is perhaps no greater and more pervasive misunderstanding in modern intellectual circles, including, I maintain, even among economists, than about the concept of the market, or as I prefer to think of it, the notion of market force. I prefer the latter because I believe that the analogy to gravity or magnetism or energy in any form is a more apt one than a definition in terms of derivative institutionalized functions like contract or bazaars or stock exchanges. Unfortunately, this bit of wisdom comes neither easily nor cheaply. It seems to some extent to be the case with physicists and mathematicians. Some seem born with a sense for the discipline, and others must struggle mightily to become conversant or at ease with the concept. But anyone who talks about a corporation's interest in its own survival has not yet reached the required level of comprehension of market forces. Such talk, like the even more hostile and ill-informed talk about corporate social responsibility, simply cannot be taken seriously by anyone who believes that market forces, and here I mean in the broadest sense, including, for example, the demand for political power, for academic promotion, grace, or what have you, that these market forces are as real, are as objective, and as profoundly a part of our existence as are water pressure, gravity, and electricity. I do not know what, to quote Irving Kristol, society requires of its own economic system, though Kristol tells us that it is more of accountability and responsibility than it is of material welfare. He may be correct, though I'm troubled by the concept of a society as opposed to individuals really requiring anything. This signifies, I suspect, a confusion between society and political power. As I understand this, however, Irving is saying that the aggregate of individuals may be making a mistake, but that is all right, and the corporations must adjust to that mistake if they are to survive. I am willing, however, to talk about individual responsibilities, including Irving Kristol's. And it is difficult for me to understand how such a respected and influential scholar is performing his job responsibly when he makes this comment. It would seem that he should be at the advance guard of those pointing out to the public how utterly stupid, venal, and self-serving our politicians and bureaucrats have been regarding our large corporations. He should be explaining how poorly mass democracy now functions in the United States, rather than berating business specialists for being poor politicians. And finally, it seems important to me that men of Crystal's vision, moral courage, and leadership should stop proposing anti-free market solutions for the problems already caused by anti-free market forces. If we follow his present prescriptions, we stand no chance to maintain those very values, standards, and belief that make this whole discussion worthwhile. And whose problem is that? The corporations? Thank you.